I'm Afshin Rakhanti, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the heart of the Middle East. 15 years ago today, Israeli commandos carried out a massacre on a six-boat flotilla seeking to bring humanitarian aid to besieged Gaza. Now, the images out of Gaza echo the worst crimes of the 20th century. Starving Palestinians are gunned down as they rush for food, herded like in Auschwitz to pick up weaponized aid as a decoy for ethnic cleansing from the so-called Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, a US-Israeli front whitewashing the Holocaust of our time. And still, NATO governments continue providing cover. Britain feigns outrage, claiming to suspend trade talks with Israel, only to dispatch trade envoys like Lord Ian Austin to promote trade with Tel Aviv, whilst UK spy planes continue circling Gaza. Newspapers like The Guardian and The Financial Times, which helped manufacture consent for Israel's war crimes, are now scrambling to rebrand themselves as critics as the scale of the genocide becomes impossible to deny. All this amidst an unprecedented assault on free speech in NATO countries. Last year, British counter-terror police raided the home of Asa Winstanley, associate editor of the Electronic Intifada, amidst his reporting on Palestine. A senior UK judge has now ruled the raid unlawful. Asa joins me now from London. Asa, so good to see you free, of course, but, and I know what's more on your mind arguably is the genocide. I mean, even here in Dubai, we have unbearably cruel Gaza. Doctor loses 9 children while on duty. We've had UN Security Council testimony all week from surgeons talking about 6-year-olds with shrapnel in their hearts and pregnant women with their pelvises obliterated and so on. So what was it like that even before we get to the beginning of your story, to hear news that a British judge, not known your country, our country, for justice, freedom for journalists, should give you some vindication, albeit as you were watching, presumably, pictures of burning children in Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, the news out of Gaza every day is just diabolical. So, you know, amidst all this darkness, it's great for once to be able to report some good news. I mean, it's just basically a small light in the darkness, basically, that that there can be some sort of pushback against this just sheer oppression that's happening in Britain. You know, it seems like the Western countries, one by one, are sort of dismantling their own institutions. What sort of small vestiges there are of democracy and freedom of speech are being obliterated to support Israel. You know, the countries like Britain and the United States, especially, and Germany, and to a lesser extent others like France and so forth, are not, you know, often said to be complicit with the Holocaust in Gaza. But it's more than that. You know, to me, it's far more than that. They're actively involved in it. It's great that there's, you know, some vestige of a independent judicial system that it can actually say that what the police did to me was effectively illegal, was unlawful.
So let's just start. So in October last year, there's a dawn raid on your house. You've been covering Palestine for 25 years, I don't know, decades.
20 years, certainly. Yeah.
And so a dawn raid on your house, just tell us about that.
Yeah, so it was the 17th of October 2024. As you said, I've been covering the issue of Palestine and the pro-Israel lobby for really 20 years. And during the genocide in the Gaza Strip, I've been continuing that coverage. You know, I wrote a book about the pro-Israel lobby and how it played a major role in the downfall of Jeremy Corbyn, the former leader of the British opposition, of the British Labour Party, now the party of government. And I've covered all sorts of these topics. And one of the things I've been covering the most since the 10th of October 2023 was the issue of the Hannibal Directive and how Israel killed many of its own people on October the 7th, you know, deliberately and otherwise in the chaos, in the sort of blanket carpet bombing of the whole area during the Palestinian military offensive that occurred on that day. And actually, the article that I'd just published not long before the police raid was related to that, how Israel killed hundreds of its own people on the 7th of October. And so, you know, a lot of my readers and viewers were very much left with the impression that this raid was a kind of punishment for daring to cover that topic. And we still don't really know what it was ultimately all about. It was a very intimidating experience. You know, it was still dark. You know, it was October, so at that time it was still dark. It was 10 to 6 in the morning.
How many officers?
It's hard to say, you know, you've woken up blurry. I was in my dressing gown, but it was around 10 officers, you know, and there was two, what do you call them? Evidence gatherers from the forensics team who were there to, you know, take possession of all my devices. And it was very intimidating. You know, they were in plain clothes. It was, I didn't see any weapons, but likely they had handcuffs and probably pepper spray and stuff like that. And at first it was very, very tense. You know, they weren't even letting me go to the toilet on my own and things like that. At first, you know, they were sort of looking, there was a holder for toilet roll and he had to check inside. I don't know what he was checking for. You know, possibly that I wanted to hide a device in there, I suppose. It was a very intimidating experience. It's something that you can mentally prepare yourself for because it had happened to others before me, and it certainly had happened to activists whose work I've been reporting on as a journalist, people like Palestine Action and so forth. So mentally, you can prepare yourself for it and think, well, this is a possibility.
Mentally also, I know both of us supported Julian Assange, and we know that he was tortured for years within an inch of his life, perhaps. So it must be going through your head what the British state can do to you, even if it's a vassal of, I know you're going to go on to whether it's Israel or the United States that were attacking you. You must have been thinking that, especially if it's a terror allegation, which I understand Richard Meadows, the journalist, is maybe facing 14 years, you could go away for a long time with no rights, no habeas corpus normal rights for you.
Yeah, I mean, this was an unusual aspect of the raid on my home, was that I actually wasn't arrested and I still have yet to be charged with anything. So, you know, when they turned up on the door and said that they had a warrant that, as it turns out, was unlawful, according to the court, you know, I just assumed I'd be spending the night in the jail cell at least. And as you said, as it's counter-terror command, they have a kind of carte blanche, you know, a lot of your rights go out the window. As it turned out, they did seem a little bit mindful of the fact that I'm a journalist. And they were very upfront with me from the beginning, saying, you know, we're aware of your profession, we know you're a journalist. And they actually wanted me to point out to them which devices in the home were the ones that I used for my journalism. So there was no question.
So they wouldn't take those ones? So they wouldn't take
those. But what they were saying was that, so we can protect, you know, we don't want to interfere with any journalistic, you know, they were trying to portray it as, oh, well, we want to protect journalistic and protected material by seizing those devices. It was all very Kafkaesque. It was very strange. I have this office here and I have it locked. And before I would open the door, I insisted on receiving legal advice, and I was able to do that using their telephone. And after receiving that legal advice, I did agree to open the office because that what that meant, in effect, by doing that, was that, I mean, if I hadn't opened the office and I hadn't agreed to identify those devices that I use for journalism, they would have just taken all the devices in the house. So, you know, like, you know, my family's devices and whatnot. So that would have been even worse. Yeah. So they would have just taken everything. So yeah, that kind of worked. They only took the ones that I use for my journalism. But they, of course, they asked for PIN codes and passwords. And to that, I said no comment. And, you know, you don't know what technological access they have to these things. Of course, everything's encrypted. But the good thing and the great thing about this ruling was that we were able, my legal team, my brilliant solicitor, Tayyip Ali at Bindmans, was able, really, from the day after to put a halt. They didn't, I mean, you never know whether they're telling the truth or not, but from what they've told us, they haven't accessed anything on the devices. There will be more to be said about that in the future as we do investigations, but...
But you got them back this week, and they've had them since October last year.
That's right.
And the audience realizes the importance of this, you don't live in a democratic country if there's no free press. So there's no democracy without a free press. So they could have been taking your sources. They could have been... Whereupon we have to get to... it was a complaint. It was them, apparently, the Metropolitan Police, Scotland Yard, of course, known for scandal, rape, murder. I don't know what else Scotland Yard is known for around the world in recent years. They said they were acting on a complaint.
Yeah, also known for spying, undercover police officers and so forth. Yeah, there was two reports that their counterterrorism internet referral unit prepared on me in October of... The first one dated October 2023 and the second one dated February 2024. So, you know, this is kind of a complaint against me that's been long running now for, you know, a year and a half or so since October 2023. And we don't know. First, you know, the first one said it was a member, an unspecified person or persons. They're trying to make it as if, look at it as if it's a member of the public, but they didn't name who it was. And the second one was... triggered by, quote, a UK-based counter-extremism think tank who expressed concern about a number of posts by Twitter user Asa Winstanley. So a counter-extremism think tank could be all kinds of people, but I've certainly reported on a lot of these so-called think tanks over the years, especially pro-Israel ones, groups
and
like...
And you've reported on their collusion with the British Foreign Office and the British state.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And this is the thing, there's a kind of symbiotic relationship between a lot of these organizations, groups like Policy Exchange and so forth, who tend to be very much on the right wing of the political spectrum. But more relevant to my reporting is really groups which you could describe as pro-Israel lobbying organizations, Zionist groups, and so on. Which really collude with the British state and really act as cutouts for the Israeli government to really infiltrate the British state. Groups like the Community Security Trust, which we know, I know from my reporting of the last 15 years, is really a cutout for Israel's Mossad intelligence agency, you know, the spying and assassination agency. I reported on that way back in 2011, how the Community Security Trust, which presents itself as just a protector of the Jewish community in Britain, actually promotes a very heavily pro-Israel line. And they do so fairly openly, but what is not so open is the fact that they have received training from Mossad. We know this from people who've worked with them in the past, people like Tony Lerman, who went from being a Zionist into an anti-Zionist and told me in his reporting that the Community Security Trust worked with, received training from Mossad. And they really, for many, many years, not only recently, have been deeply embedded inside the British state, inside the Home Office, inside British police agencies. You know, they receive a lot of their information from them. So, you know, we don't know which think tank this was. But if I was to draw up a list of the top 10 most likely, the CST would certainly be on it.
A UK judge ruled the raid unlawful. Asa Winstanley, I'll stop you there. More from the Electronic Intifada associate editor and author of Weaponizing Antisemitism, How the Israel Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada, Asa Winstanley. Hey, so we're talking about the UK judge's ruling that the Dawn raid on your home and the seizure of your assets was unlawful. Before I go on to the genocide itself, what sort of solidarity did you get from other journalists on the The Guardian? Or papers like that that have suddenly discovered that maybe something untoward is happening in Gaza? And do you believe there have been some sort of warnings to newspapers not to cover your case, even though if the judge had not this week said it was unlawful, any journalist practicing in Britain could have all their equipment taken away for forever?
Yeah, well, this is why I think I received the backing of the NUJ, the National Union of Journalists. You know, they've put out statements supporting me, and actually, they even backed, they paid for my legal team, type Elliot Bindmans and my barrister, which was a really essential part of this legal victory. But in terms of mainstream newspapers, not only has there been no support, there's been a complete kind of omerta. There's been complete silence on it. And in fact, even last week, LBC Radio, Nick Ferrari in the morning, a caller called in and mentioned Richard Medhurst's case and my case, and we were swiftly cut off by Nick Ferrari, who said, "Oh, hang on. Who's this happening to? You can't just say that's happening. We need names." The caller proceeded to give the names, and he said, "Oh, well, you can't just throw out names of Joe Bloggs or whoever. You know, my researcher will need to check this." And the caller was swiftly cut off. So, you know, there's this kind of weird media silence whereby, you know, you can't talk about it because it hasn't been reported, but then it hasn't been reported because no one within the mainstream is talking about it. So that's very strange. There's been the excellent journalist Matt Kennard, who, you know, I'm sure you must have had on in the past, who has recently obtained, and he put out on his Twitter X account, there was actually a denotice, you know, whatever it's called now, effectively a sort of voluntary censorship by the British mainstream media. There was a kind of order that went out strongly discouraging the denotice committee participants from reporting on the activities of the so-called counter-terror police. So, it, you know, the denotice committee is supposedly voluntary, so there's nothing binding these journalists from reporting on the activities of the counter-terrorism police, but they seem to have kind of agreed to censor themselves within the interests of the British
state. Therefore, all journalists
and not report on these things.
All journalists not towing the Israeli Netanyahu or Israeli, any kind of American line, as it were, Israel lobby line, is therefore somehow, when attacked, not to be talked about. For our international audience, the denotice committee, they, I think they sent us something once going underground when we were based in Britain. We ignored it. It's staffed by MI6 and secret service personnel. How totalitarian is it getting there, except for this week's success of your case where the judge ruled it unlawful? How totalitarian is it getting? And in the coverage of Gaza, are you noticing a lockstep, sudden change? And how appalling has it been, though, in the past couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, it is terrible. The media has been complicit, really, with the genocide in Gaza. Absolutely, you know, by constantly having on Israeli official spokespeople to really parrot the effectively a Holocaust denial line, whereby they're saying, "Oh, well, you know, people are only dying in Gaza because of Hamas. It's got nothing to do with us. You know, oh, there's no starvation in Gaza." All these kinds of lies. And they're, you know, then putting out this kind of soft questioning of them and challenging them a little bit. But really, ultimately, the genocide denial line by the Israeli spokespeople is being put forward. And there is a kind of, in recent weeks, there is a kind of thawing of that a little bit. And there's kind of some humanitarian voices being put forward. And you saw, for example, a front page of the Independent newspaper, or the I newspaper, as it's called now, saying that, oh, we should be ashamed of the media silence on Gaza. Well, you know, it's a bit like Joe Biden complaining about not being able to, people can't access healthcare. You know, you're the president, they're the media doing the silence, you know. So, and it's not just a matter of silence, isn't it? Like I said earlier, it's a matter of active complicity in terms of the Israeli government, not just complicity, but active, enthusiastic involvement in this genocide. For example, you know, we've seen the latest thing where David Lammy said that they were suspending the foreign minister saying that the British government was suspending trade negotiation talks with Israel. And then, you know, a few days later, Ian Austin, their trade envoy, being cited and in Haifa and being posted by the British consulate, saying that, you know, he's welcome to Israel. And it looks like the whole thing's a farce. You know, we saw last year the ending, the suspension of a very limited number of weapons licenses to Israel. although the vast majority of them would carry on. But now, you know, from independent journalists like Matt Kennard and like the National, the Scottish newspaper, the pro-independent Scottish newspaper, have been able to show that actually these licenses that they said were ending have only continued, that they've actually increased since David Lammy. So there's active involvement of the British military in the genocide with spy flights that have been going over Gaza, feeding intelligence to the Israelis and helping them in this genocide. So it's alarming. It's incredibly concerning, and the history won't look well on it. And the media's role has just been active complicity in it, you know, at best silence and at worst really promoting the Israeli line.
Yeah, but there won't be any prosecutions of these people, will there? And I suppose in your book, you charted who these Labour figures are. I mean, the British Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, was bankrolled by a Israel lobbyist, as so many of them are, promoted by Jeremy Corbyn, a lot of those people, it has to be said. And even your Dawn Raid, the Home Secretary Yvette Cooper, it was my misfortune to interview once. I think, she, you know, these people are all related to it, the Israel lobby in the first place. Clearly, if Kamala Harris, Holocaust Harris, had been elected, the genocide would have just sped along. What did you make of the fact that Trump was able to make one phone call and stop, pause it for a couple of weeks before then it vamping up in a worse way than ever in terms of the starvation and prevention of aid getting through, and now him saying that he will do something about Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that's right. I think that on both sides of the Atlantic, you see this strange dynamic where by the supposedly progressive liberal parties, the Democrats and Labour, have actually both been worse and actively more pro-genocide than even the right-wing side. You know, they're both pro-genocide, but the Labour government, since it came in July last year, has actually ramped up Britain's involvement in the Israeli genocide. Like you alluded to, the majority of the Labour cabinet is all been funded, supported and backed by pro-Israel lobbyists, people like Trevor Chin, who fund these pro-Israel groups within the Labour Party and within all political parties. David Garrett is another example, who's actually funded pro-Israel organisations on both sides of the Labour-Conservative political split.
Obviously, I should say, here in Dubai, Britain is such a backwater, it's such a vassal state, spending all of its money to Zelensky. No one really cares about it, arguably. And actually, destroying all of your appalling media in your country has been Elon Musk to an extent. How far do you think the lack of censorship, to an extent, Elon Musk, how that has helped awareness of the genocide this time around? I mean, they've obviously tried to stop TikTok before.
Well, it's been interesting because there has been a lot of things that have allowed, due to a kind of laissez-faire attitude by Elon Musk's new X regime over Twitter, to a limited extent. I mean, there's definitely limits of it, but there has been more stuff allowed to be posted to X than this, in some ways, censorship has been less extreme than on certainly on Meta and so forth. There's one aspect to my case actually that involves X, which is that the pretext for the raid was that so they're investigating me, and they're still investigating me for my public posts on social media, for my tweets essentially. So why did they need to access my private devices? You know, those tweets are all public. You know, you can investigate them from the public posts. There's nothing secret there. So why did they need this private stuff? Well, what they said to the court, what they claimed to the court, and in correspondence with my lawyers, their only reason was that they needed to verify that it was actually my Twitter account and that I made these posts, you know. So that's a completely ridiculous it's completely ridiculous pretext, but that's what they put forward, and that's why their request to access the files on my devices failed in the court, because that was such a ridiculous reason. You know, they need a reason to suspect criminality, and they weren't actually able to put that forward. But the interesting thing is that they actually put in a request to X in San Francisco for them to confirmed that it was my Twitter account, and that X refused to do that because there's not a treaty in place between Britain and the United States on that. And so, you know, I do wonder if it was related to posts on a Meta platform, whether Meta, Facebook or Instagram or whoever, they might have been more forthcoming. So, you know, that was an interesting aspect to this case. There's certainly a lot of censorship around, you know, there's no other issue where, you know, of course, the Russian military operation in Ukraine, the Ukraine war, there's a lot of censorship around that as well, certainly because it relates to NATO. But there's really no other issue other than Palestine that gets censored on these online platforms so much.
Just finally, I mean, you've written that Israel has no right to exist. I think many in the global south share that opinion. But working on this subject in this field for 20 years, do you see obviously the horror, but the end game now for Israel? It's over, this project, the Israel project.
Well, on the Electronic Intifada live stream, we've interviewed some guests who talked about this this very topic in very interesting ways quite recently. You know, we had the very left-wing barrister Frank McGuinness on our most recent show, and he says that Zionism has never been weaker. I think that's true in a lot of ways. But it's paradoxical because in some ways it appears to be incredibly, incredibly strong, and it is still incredibly, incredibly strong. We've had the dissident Israeli historian Ilan Pepe on the live stream in the past as well. And the way he puts it is that Zionism is, the end game is starting, but you have to look at it in a correct historical perspective, which is this didn't begin in a It certainly didn't begin on October 7, 2023. It didn't begin in 1967. And it didn't even begin, in some ways, in 1948, when Israel was founded on the literal mass graves of Palestinians by driving out hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, expelling them from Palestine. Really, this started 130 years ago with the first Zionist colonies in Palestine and the expulsion of peasant farmers from their lands. During the Ottoman Empire, first of all, but more even much more during the period of British colonial occupation of Palestine, beginning in 1917. So this is this colonization, this Zionist settler colonial project is really 130 years old. And so the end game, the end phase of Zionism, the Zionist settler colony project, is going to be, unfortunately, most likely, it seems, is going to be very, very bloody. We're seeing it now. You know, we're seeing the absolute holocaust of Palestinians.
Hazelman Stanley, thank you. That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those suffering the impact of the US-UK-EU armed genocide in Gaza. We'll be back on Monday for more on Western European totalitarianism with blacklisted British scholar Professor Richard Sakwa. His crime was to dare to write that Russia was provoked into the NATO proxy war through Ukraine. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.